Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nonprofit U, a forum where nonprofit stakeholders can share lessons learned and discuss the latest developments in the industry. My name is Valerie Leonard, your host. I'm a consultant to nonprofits, and I specialize in community and organizational development. I work with nonprofit organizations to help them make a stronger impact to their clients and communities. And you can find Nonprofit U on Facebook and Twitter. I encourage you to comment early and often using the hashtags Nonprofit U, CTBA, or Data Driven Justice. You can also leave comments on blogtalkradio.com/nonprofit_U. The chat room is open, and you can post comments and questions. And in order to use the chat room, you must open a listener-only account. You'll find a link to open the account on the episode page, and you can also email me questions at consulting@valeriefleonard.com or send messages through Facebook and Twitter. You'll find a Facebook fan page on Nonprofit U. I'm sorry, you'll find a Nonprofit U fan page on Facebook, and the Twitter account is @NonprofitU. We'll be taking questions by phone and from our chat room at about the 20-minute mark, and the call-in number is area code 347-884-8121. Today's episode is Data Driven Justice. We'll talk about CTBA's programs and services and ways community based organizations can use data to drive policy, advocacy, and programs in their communities. Again, we encourage you to call in with questions and participate in live chats at about the 20 minute mark. The call in number is 347-884-8121. Nonprofit professionals, educators, and community stakeholders are especially encouraged to call in and share your stories. In the event that I forget to call out this number, you'll find the number at the top of the episode page. Today's guest is Ralph Martiri. He's the Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, or CTBA for short. In February 2011, Ralph was appointed to serve on the U.S. Department of Education Equity and Excellence Commission. He's a distinguished lecturer on public policy for Roosevelt University and has taught fiscal policy seminars for various universities, as well as the International Fulbright Scholar Program. Ralph has received numerous awards for his work on education policy reform. This includes the 2000 Champion of Freedom Award. This was presented by the Rainbow Push Coalition to individuals whose professional work embodies the work of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. They're also recognized for their commitment to equal education opportunities and civil rights in education. He also received the Ben C. Hubbard Leadership Award given by Illinois State University to individuals who have greatly benefited education in Illinois. He was elected to serve on the school board of River Forest District 90, where he still serves. And Ralph is also a regular columnist on education, fiscal, and economic policy for the State Journal Register, as well as the Daily Herald. Ralph received his BA in history with highest honors from Indiana University and his JD from the University of Michigan. He's married to Mary Kay Martiri, and they have two children, a son, Nicholas, and a daughter, Valerie. He has coached Little League Baseball, boys basketball, and girls soccer. You can find the bio for Ralph on my blog, Nonprofit U, under episode 21, Data Driven Justice. Go to valeriefleonard.com/nonprofitU and click on to the episodes page. So thanks for being on the show, Ralph. It's indeed an honor to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about CTBA and how you came to work with them?
Well, CTBA is an odd duck. It's a bipartisan organization that works on promoting social and economic justice, but we do it through systems change and evidence-based change and those kinds of things. And, you know, I was the initial executive director of the organization hired after a search was done. The Woods Fund of Chicago started CTBA, and they retained some consultants. And I was working as a lawyer, and they asked me if I'd like to quit being a lawyer and do this for a living. And I said, sure, why not?
Oh, awesome. So CTBA provides technical support to community advocacy and religious organizations in various forms. And this can include things like an analysis of the budgetary or other policy initiatives? And can you give us some examples of your technical support for state and local organizations and some of the outcomes?
Yeah, you know, one of the best examples of this work was when we were retained by CHI, the Chicago Housing Initiative, to help them understand what was happening with the CHA and its utilization or lack of utilization of voucher funding from the feds. And unlike many other public housing authorities, the CHA is deregulated. So when it gets its funding from the feds, it doesn't have to put its housing funds for public housing units in one special account and its voucher money in another. It could commingle those funds and then spend the money on either issuing vouchers or producing and maintaining public housing, whichever does a better job of meeting local demand. Well, the people at the Chicago Housing Initiative were a little concerned because they didn't see really an appropriate amount of housing vouchers and or housing stock being issued based on the funding that the Chicago Housing Authority was getting from HUD. So they asked us to dig into their finances, and we did. And we dug into their budget statements, et cetera. And what we found was you really had to look at, they issue four different budget reports, and you had to reconcile the four. And what we found, I know it's a mess. And what we found by reconciling the four was that CHA was taking voucher money, and as far as the feds were concerned, they reported to the feds, to HUD, that they were utilizing the voucher money for public housing. But in their audited financial reports, it appeared as if instead of issuing the money for anything, they were building a huge reserve, dollar for dollar, the differential between what they weren't spending on vouchers and the growth in their reserve was going up. And so we dug even further and found in report number three that what they were really doing was, in fact, that they were taking their voucher money and they were allocating it to depreciation costs. Well, depreciation doesn't have a cost. It's a non-cash outlay.
Right.
It's just the value of your asset goes down. So by doing that, they could claim they were spending the voucher money on housing, but instead they weren't spending it on anything and building up a big reserve. And so that's led to a bunch of action. In fact, CTBA is now working on reviewing some of these practices done by other housing authorities. But that's just an example. I mean, organizations come to us all the time for briefings on the state or the city budget or what's the trend in funding for this particular service over time, or how do they even understand what's going on in the state's fiscal processes. So we are more than happy to provide that sort of assistance to community groups across the state.
Okay, great. So that was literally an example of money just literally going up in the thin air, right? Just imaginary.
Yeah, not even being used. And so, you know, and what's really frustrating about that is they could have been issuing an extra 13,500 vouchers per year, Valerie, and they weren't. And the existing demand for housing assistance, the waiting list is over 30,000. But the last time they opened up the waiting list, there were over 200,000 people applied. So it was arbitrarily capped at 30. So net, there was certainly a lot of existing demand for this housing money to reach the streets in the form of assistance, and it just wasn't.
That's too bad. So can you share some examples of how CTBA has used data and research to address racial and economic disparity? I think that's a really good segue for this question.
Yeah, so for a long time, you know, CTBA, what we do is we look at the fiscal side of the ledger and we tie it to the policy delivery side of the ledger. You basically can't have high-quality public services if you have inadequate capacity on the front end.
Mm-hmm.
And after reviewing a number of different structures, for instance, the state's tax policy and the state's education funding policy, we noticed that the way these policies were designed, these major policy structures, tax policy on the one hand, education funding policy on the other, it actually worked structurally to single out African-American children for disadvantage. And here's what the data had to tell us about that. So Illinois has made the decision to be a low-tax state at the state level, very low tax. And because of that, it does not fund an adequate portion of education from state-based resources. This pushes the primary obligation to fund public schools down to the local level, which means property taxes. So we're the most reliant state in the nation on property taxes to fund schools. Well, as it turns out, over half of all black kids in Illinois attend the 5% of school districts with the greatest poverty and hence the lowest property values. Actually, 93% of the state's black kids attend schools in districts that have concentrated poverty levels of 30% or greater, and property values fall off the map at about 20%. The net result was this over-reliance on this local tax source, property wealth, as the most important fiscal resources used to fund schools, created an educational funding system that singled out black kids for disadvantage and significant disadvantage, about $1,100 less per child every year being spent on black children than on white children in Illinois, K through 12. So that's an amazing thing to see in the data. And it's how we do our work, right? We really look at what's actually happening and whether or not these large policy systems are doing what they're supposed to do, create access to opportunity for everyone. And in this case, they're actually singling out black kids for disadvantage.
Oh, my goodness. So is there anybody who's filing a lawsuit?
Well, you know, there's people who have filed lawsuits, but sadly, on education funding, that's not really a vehicle that will work in Illinois because our Constitution does not require the state to fund a majority of education, nor does it make education funding a civil right or a basic right. So we have flawed constitutional law in Illinois that makes that difficult. But here's the real kicker. I mean, I'm sure you know this, Valerie, because you keep on top of these kinds of things, but over time, the correlation between educational attainment and economic viability has grown closer, right? So the greater your level of educational attainment, the lower your unemployment rate. But also what's interesting is educational attainment is now tied to wage. And so the only cohort of workers that have seen their incomes increase at a rate greater than inflation since 1980 have a college degree. So what we've done by singling out black kids for inferior education is ensure they're not going to be competitive with their white peers for that crucial credentialing at the next level. And if that's really the case, if that's actually happening, then it'll show up in the wage data, and it very much has. Mm-hmm. So the wage gap between whites and blacks in Illinois has gotten worse significantly since 1980. It's actually gotten worse by over 197%. I think what I sent you in the handwritten thing said 94%. That's a typo.
Wow. I wish the typo were more true. I mean, even though that's still drastic.
Yeah, still, that's horrible, yeah. But I just want to give your audience sort of an idea of the size of the problem.
Yes. So you guys also provide technical support to legislators. And can you give us, an indication of what that support might look like, some of the outcomes, and how local community groups can either participate or benefit from that advocacy?
Yeah, we work, any legislator in either party, once again, we're bipartisan, so we really don't care about anyone's party affiliation. And actually, we don't really care about an initiative being liberal or conservative or anywhere in the middle. We only care about whether or not it meets best practices and data. Once an elected official appoints us as a technical advisor, we provide that elected official with research. We testify at hearings. We speak at town hall forums. We even draft legislation. And so, for instance, I don't know if you remember this guy. He used to be a state senator in Illinois. His name was Barack Obama. Do you remember him?
I think so.
Yeah. So when Barack was a state senator, we were his technical advisor. We actually drafted the state's earned income tax credit legislation for him.
Okay.
So that's sort of an example of how we work with legislators to help them, produce final pieces of legislation that are literally predicated on best practices and have a really good chance of creating some opportunity, maybe driving some social or economic justice if they're implemented.
But we have a tendency to examine issues like education, workforce development, housing, et cetera, in silos. Everybody has their own little fiefdom. On the other hand, CTBA tends to look at community development issues holistically, and you place them on a continuum that allows individuals with no income as well as low-income individuals to move to self-sufficiency. And then this, in turn, contributes to the growth of a vibrant, upwardly mobile middle class, and then it counters long-term structural problems. Can you share with us some examples? And we'd be most interested in knowing the communities and organizations with which you've worked, you know, some of the challenges you've overcome to implement your framework and some of the results.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been engaged really for the last 3 years in the Woodlawn community, very closely working with Dr. Reverend Brazier as he tries to put together a very strategic, long-term, and comprehensive approach to developing the Woodlawn community into a self-sustaining, viable, middle-income or above community. And so that requires a lot of different steps. Where we've provided technical assistance to Dr. Brazier is on sort of coordinating the different legislative and policy structures at the federal, state, and local level that combine on education and on healthcare, on access to social services, and a little bit on economic development to try to help him and community groups in Woodlawn, number one, take full advantage of these structures that are out there to maximize the investments being made in the Woodlawn community. And then number two, help put together a very strategic path for ensuring they have in place those elements that are needed for a community to ultimately take off and become self-sustaining. What you really want to do is say, all right, our community right now is low income and it has this amount of crime and this amount of unemployment and this amount of lack of opportunity, if you will, lack of jobs or whatever, whatever. Let's look at a self-sustaining middle-income community, you know, pick one that's doing okay, like Peoria. You know, what's that community in Peoria look like? How did it attract jobs? You know, how did it build out, et cetera, and see what it takes to move Woodlawn from where it is now to maybe Peoria in 10 years, and from Peoria to maybe Barrington in 10 years after that. So the idea is to just keep working at the community level to move the community forward strategically, make sure things are in place. And Reverend Brazier is ahead of the curve on a lot of those things, including on public safety and that kind of thing. Now, we've also worked very closely with Reverend Jackson and the Rainbow Push Coalition on everything from, geez, I don't know, educational equity, prison labor concerns, economic justice issues, healthcare inequities, et cetera. So we're really happy to work closely with individuals that are engaged at the community and grassroots level because, you know, we don't have that capacity at CTBA, so it's a nice synergy, right? We have the capacity to do sound research and analysis. We could certainly identify best practices. We could identify creative solutions. But we can't do that very well if we're not being informed from the community as to where their concerns are, how they'd like to move forward first, right? We can't pick their priorities for them, nor should we. We certainly can't do the community engagement piece. That's beyond our skill set. But I tell you what, people that do organizing and people that work in grassroots and community-based organizations have those skills to the nines. And so they just need a little technical support on the other stuff, and boy, do they know how to move it once it gets to them.
Yeah, that's exciting. I didn't know about your work in Woodlawn. North Lawndale is just starting a comprehensive community plan, and we're looking at capacity building, I guess, along the various quality of life sectors, trying to better deliver services in a meaningful way. And then we're also going to be looking at the physical community. We got a grant from CMAP for them to help us with the comprehensive planning. And then when I heard you speak of what Woodlawn was doing, you know, looking at how the federal policies can impact what they're doing to bring greater resources into the community, it sounds like we need to have a conversation offline sometime after this show.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's probably not what you meant, but you know, I'm always listening for
it's all good. You count as one of those people helping moving things forward. So.
Okay. So I had the opportunity to serve on a panel with Bobby Otter, and Bobby Otter, for the listening audience, he's the budget director for CTBA. And we were talking about the Illinois state budget impasse. This was back in March of this year. At the time, the governor was talking about closing a $1.6 billion budget gap for 2015, and then he projected at that time a $6 billion budget deficit for FY 2016. And the fiscal year 2015 budget deficit, that was closed by unilaterally terminating contracts, sweeping cash from accounts that had surpluses to cover shortfalls in other accounts, and by cutting the budget by 2.25% across the board. So June 30th is coming gone. There was no budget passed for fiscal 2016. Here it is, November. We're still waiting for that budget. And I'm just wondering, what's happening in Springfield? Any updates, and what are the issues and alternatives that have been presented?
There is very little happening in Springfield. I know that, you know, on the 18th, the governor is supposed to be sitting down in public with the four legislative leaders, Speaker Madigan and Minority Leader, she's a Republican Minority Leader. His name is escaping now. The Republican Minority Leader in the House, and Durkin, that's his name, and Senate President Cullerton, and Republican Minority Leader Redonio in the Senate. And they're going to have this big public meeting and yada, yada, and nothing's going to come out of it. So basically the update is there is no update. We're at a classic standoff where the governor says, yeah, we need more revenue to solve our state's fiscal problems, no question, but I'm not willing to negotiate on revenue until you Democrats give me my quote-unquote turnaround agenda. Well, his turnaround agenda is primarily focused on a couple of things, and number one, dramatically reducing collective bargaining rights, in fact, moving a bunch of legislation that's very similar to right-to-work states where unions really don't have the capacity to organize anymore. He wants to freeze property taxes. He wants to create term limits. He wants to change how legislative maps are drawn, and he wants to reduce workers' compensation costs and institute tort reform. Mm-hmm. None of that has any impact on the state budget. So part one of the governor's negotiation strategy is really curious because he's tied fiscal matters to entirely non-fiscal matters. Number two, his turnaround agenda isn't really supported by the data as something that will, in fact, create economic or job growth in Illinois. Those states that have moved to a right-to-work model have not experienced better job growth than other states, but they have experienced wage deflation. So wages don't grow nearly as rapidly in the right-to-work states as they do with states that have more broad union rights. Now, that's really important from an economic standpoint because the economy is driven very much by consumer spending. So if wages aren't going up, that means most people don't have more to spend in the economy, which creates private sector economic problems, and it actually retards job growth. In fact, the only thing that has gone up in right-to-work states from an economic standpoint has been the profits of the proprietors of the businesses.
Wow.
And no job growth or whatever. So that's problem number one, is he's got a bunch of reforms that he sincerely believes in, and he does. It's just that they're not very data-based, and so they wouldn't be effective at creating economic stimulus in Illinois. And I think number two, particularly his stance on right to work and collective bargaining, he believes that the Democrats only support collective bargaining and are against right to work because they're being beaten up by the unions. Well, that's not true, actually. While certainly the unions and their members are active in lobbying for these things and promoting these things, most Democrats, not all of them, and once again, there are always exceptions, but most Democrats, as a matter of principle, believe that taking away collective bargaining rights, moving to a right-to-work scenario, would actually harm their constituents, harm the state's economy, and hence they're opposed to those reforms on principle. So you've got a governor who really wants to make these changes on principle, and Democrats who are opposed to making these changes on principle. So there's no wiggle room for a quick and fast negotiated settlement there. The other thing, I think on the workers' comp issue, actually, it's the one where there might be some room to negotiate. If you look at Illinois, we're sort of unique on workers' compensation, whereas the average benefit paid, we're on the low end in the Midwest, but the average cost for benefit paid, we're at the high end, third highest. So that's an odd series of data, and it indicates that we have a relatively inefficient system that drives up costs. And frankly, employers don't really care if the cost is high because of administrative and legal fees and the amount of time it takes to resolve claims, or if it's high because of the benefits being paid. What they care about is that it's high. So they want it to come down. So there should be a way to negotiate some changes in policy where some of these attenuating costs around workers' compensation, particularly the long amount of time it takes to resolve the claims and hence the heightened amount of legal fees, can be reduced, driving down the cost without reducing the benefit to workers who are injured on the job. So that's one area where actually the Democrats and Governor Rauner could sit down and strike a deal. I don't really see it on much of the other stuff. Tort reform, he's not been specific at all. It's hard to tell even what he wants there. And on the legislative changes on the map, you know, whatever party's in power is against that, and whatever party is not in power is for that. That's the way it was when the Republicans were in things. So the Democrats happen to be the party in power. They're going to be against it. And I don't really see room for negotiation there.
Right. Just out of curiosity, are you, and when I say you, CTBA, are you part of the group of organizations that have requested that the governor come and sit down with the leaders and Springfield? I think next week there's supposed to be a meeting.
Yeah, this is that meeting I was talking about. I don't know if the RBC was part of that group. I mean, if they were, then we are. We haven't really focused on that kind of public call because, frankly, that usually doesn't accomplish much. I mean, what we're really trying to do is work with leading members in both parties behind the scenes on understanding the impacts of not having a budget, and these impacts are worse, obviously, in low middle income communities. I mean, it's not the services in Barrington that are being cut. And so it's Woodlawn, it's Austin, it's East St. Louis, it's Marion, it's Lawndale. Now you pick the community that's disadvantaged, and that's where they're losing services. And when they lose access to services, and I don't think that many people in Rauner's administration understand this, because if they understand it, I think they'd have a slightly different tack. When they lose these services, they're not just losing sort of the support that vulnerable populations rely on it for a hand up to try to get access to opportunity. They're also losing anchor employers. And generally speaking, many of these social service providers pay a median wage above the median wage otherwise prevalent in the community. So when you start closing those guys down, you're losing a lot of economic activity, and that's going to hurt the private sector job situation significantly. And so you start creating a negative economic multiplier that will roll through these communities that aren't exactly well-to-do to begin with, and that's just devastating. So, and I do know the governor honestly cares about job growth and those kinds of things, and so it'd be interesting to see how he'd react if he really – we, meaning the advocacy community, in addition to focusing on sort of the harm done to those individuals who rely on these services, the harm done to the economy.
Right. And North Lawndale is a stark example. You know, 25% of our workforce is in social services. Our largest employer is Mount Sinai Hospital, which depends very heavily on the state. I think about 80 or 90% of their reimbursement is from public sources. You know, they've got 17,000 Medicaid folks you know, so we're hurting. We're seriously hurting. You know, compare this to, I guess, the state's economy, which is about 8% dependent on nonprofits, 25%. And that's just of the workforce. You know, that doesn't include all the other folks who are dependent on, you know, the various services. So we're hurting. And
right.
I just raised that question about your being in the room because clearly you're one of the few adults I've heard on the budget issue, quite honestly. They need to have you in that room.
Yeah, well, we try to be helpful, but, you know, you got to be invited in.
right. So when we look at the alternatives, you know, whatever is going to be proposed in Springfield, obviously it's going to be a short-term fix. CTBA has put out a new report. It's all about the revenue, a common sense solution for Illinois' fiscal solvency. Can you share some of the highlights of the report and the recommendations?
Yeah, real quickly, and people can pull this right off of our website. But we need to do a couple of things if we're going to get the state's fiscal house in order to both our tax policy and our pension funding law. So the tax policy stuff, you know, there aren't a lot of tools in the kit. You really got your income and your sales tax. And so from the income tax standpoint, we need to bump the rate up a little bit, certainly from its current level of 3.75 to at least 4.75. And that would generate over $3 billion, I think 3.3. We had to bump up the corporate income tax rate a little bit too.
Okay.
We probably need to tax some retirement income. We don't want to harm low-income seniors, so you would still let the full exemption for all retirement income stay in place for people with $50,000 a year or less in AGI. But after that, phase out the exemption. Expand the state sales tax base to include consumer services. And that's really the main series of options that we need to get our fiscal house from a tax policy standpoint in order. And then the final thing we need to do is look at our pension debt and re-amortize it. I mean, the way the current law for how we repay what we've borrowed from our pension systems is just not affordable or attainable. It jumps in annual increments that are huge. It looks like a ski slope. So to level that out, just like a mortgage payment would be same dollar amount every year, but that level dollar amount would be sufficient to grow the state's funded ratio so that those systems ultimately become healthy. That's the trick, and we've identified that. We do those few things, we actually could solve all the state's fiscal problems. To give you one little piece of context, we need to raise between, you know, $7 and $8 billion in new revenue. That's a lot of money. But Illinois has a $745 billion economy, so it's basically 1% of our economic activity. And in that context, it's really such a small tax increase, it can't even be measured.
I like. I just want to remind our callers, you can call in with questions. The phone number is 347-884-8121. Again, that's area code 347-884-8121. So we have a tendency to overlook the economic power of nonprofit organizations. A donors forum report indicated that nonprofits contribute about 8% of the state's GDP or gross domestic product. And then, as I mentioned before, we found that, you know, nonprofits make up about 25% of our local economy. And then we noticed that CTBA recently completed a report for Uptown United to get a sense for the economic impact of nonprofits in that community. Can you share some of the highlights and the implications, particularly in the current environment?
Yeah, I mean, this gets a little bit to what we were discussing earlier, right, Valerie, the economic impact of these nonprofits, and it's substantial. So we found that in Uptown, you know, the nonprofits had over 1,300 workers. 63% of them have an advanced degree. These workers spent around $60,000 a week or over $3 million annually at businesses in the neighborhood. I mean, you know, restaurants, retail stores, all those kinds of things, getting your watch fixed, getting your computer fixed, whatever, right in the community. And there's just a major economic engine, and this is what I think is missing from the public debate. You hear all this talk about, you know, We're going to lose child care services, we're going to lose domestic violence centers and terrible consequences that has on people. And mm-hmm. we don't hear that, by the way, we're going to make the community worse off economically too, so that over the long run, not only will those problems that these service providers designed to counter continue, they'll actually get worse. So it's just mm-hmm. it's to me, Valerie, it's amazing that we don't recognize the economic value that these nonprofits are, because they might be nonprofits, but they're also employers.
Right. And they're clearly stimulating the local economy from what your results are showing.
Right.
So what are some of the lessons you've learned in your years of policy and advocacy?
Well, you know, there's so many. But, I mean, the big picture is doing public policy, it's hard. And if you're mm-hmm. going to do it right, it's real hard, because what you're doing is you're allocating scarce resources to needs. And one of the mm-hmm. truisms is where resources are least, needs are greatest. So there's always some sort of redistributive effect if you're doing it right, and that's a yeah. challenge. And then you look at coming and play a role, emotionally charged issues like race and income class then play a role, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you've got a lot of demagoguery and rhetoric and not a lot of reality and policy making. So what we've decided is the only way you can overcome these challenges are, number one, you have to be committed to stay in this for the long haul, right? Number two, right. you take this evidence-based approach. You try to frame the issues in a way that bridges rather than reinforces ideological divides. You demonstrate with thorough data and research that policy initiative A will work for the following five reasons, or will ameliorate the problem for the following six reasons, whatever it is. And then mm-hmm. you inform the media, you inform the legislators, you inform local community groups. And after everyone says no to you for about 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, eventually they start saying yes if you stay in the message. So it's that kind of long-term process involving research, evidence-based approach, getting past mm-hmm. ideological divides, overcoming political hurdles, working closely with the people in the community who are being affected by the policy changes you're trying to enact, working with the media to educate them, working with the general public to educate them, and, of course, working with legislators and administrative officials to educate them.
So what advice would you give to emerging organizations that are struggling to survive in this current climate? This is really a new normal, I think.
Yeah, no, good luck. I mean, it is so off the charts from what's going on in the past, the stalemate in Springfield, and it has so many consequences that if you're new into this, I think mm-hmm. it's a very challenging time, because the old rules about how you went together around putting together your board, creating support for your organization, raising money, working with the public sector to ensure that, you know, you were well-positioned to meet demographically driven needs, and you were following whatever regulatory requirements were imposed on you for operating your business. All that stuff is broken down. So
wow.
even organizations that have been out there a very long time are struggling to keep the lights on and to make ends meet. I think the challenges are unique, and hopefully at some juncture the Democrats and the governor will be able to sit down together and deal with the budget on an adult basis, and hopefully mm-hmm. that'll create a more normal pathway for these newly established nonprofits to actually play those really crucial roles, frankly, we need them to play in communities across the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to give one more call out for folks if they have questions. The call-in number is 347-884-8121. Okay, so we've come to the end of our show, and I'd like to thank Ralph Martiri, he's the Executive Director of CPBA, for being my guest today. Ralph, would you care to share any parting thoughts and tell us how we can reach you?
Well, you can always reach our organization by going to our website, ctbaonline.org. All of our contact information is there. We have Tracy Schoenberger at our office who handles all scheduling, so if people want to come in and meet with any of our professionals to talk about possibly collaborating, we're more than happy to do that. And, of course, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, so you can make your tax-deductible contribution to the center, and that would make you a great American.
Yes, yes, yes. So you know from whence you speak from several perspectives, right?
Yes.
So thank you for listening to Nonprofit You Blog Radio Talk Show. The show will be available for download within about an hour. Be sure to tune in next week when our guest will be Robert Douglas. He's the founder and co-director of the SON Foundation. We'll talk about SON's mentoring programs and civic engagement. Robert will also share innovative strategies to reverse disinvestment in inner-city schools and communities, and there will be opportunities for listeners to call in with questions and participate in live chat. Looking forward to a very lively discussion. So thanks again for listening, and hope to hear you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.